Let me start by giving you the big picture of physics. Physics has two major themes. The first is about structure. It's about how things are arranged, from the very small, the structure of atoms and nuclei, or electrons and nuclei and atoms, getting bigger to atoms in molecules, molecules in cells and organisms, eventually animals into the larger world picture, and of course, eventually planets in solar systems, in galaxies, to the large-scale structure of the universe. So physics covers all those domains. Now, some may argue that chemistry fits in there somewhere, and biology, and maybe even psychology. Those are sub-branches of physics. The other main theme in physics is how things move, the science of dynamics. And again, that covers everything from the very small, the idea of how molecules react and how they how new molecules are so born, to how larger molecules conform or deconform to enable them to have functions in biology, to even things that are perhaps more nebulous and intangible. Information. Information is a central theme in physics. And of course, it's critically important in our own lives. Where would we be without the internet? Of course, things like human dynamics, physical dynamics, all the way into the timescales and dynamics and processes by which the large-scale structure of the universe is formed. So, all of those things. And to give you an indication of what sort of timescales are involved, I've just taken a subset of that here. And what you see here are several different, more or less physically recognizable entities. And underneath is a timeline, if you like. So each of these numbers here represents a number of seconds that are broadly associated with the motion shown in the picture above. So starting on the left-hand side, on the order of 10 seconds to on the order of 1,000th of a second, that's the sort of regime where we think about normal physical motion. And that goes by the prefix milli, so this is the regime of milliseconds. As you go smaller, then you get into non-animal sorts of time scales. So the picture of this drop of milk falling into a bowl of milk, the time scales for that sort of motion are around a millionth of a second, and that prefix is micro. But we can go further down into the realm of electronics, and that gets down into a billionth of a second, and that's the nanosecond regime. And then as we go further down, we get into the timescales associated with the motion of fundamental constituents of matter, at least the bits that stick together on their own. So timescales associated with motion in molecules and in atoms is in this region of a thousand billionth of a second, that's the picosecond, to a billion billionth of a second, sorry, a million billionth of a second, that's the femtosecond regime. And what I'll show you at the end is that the cutting edge of this technology is reaching down into this attosecond regime, that of a billion billionth of a second. And those timescales are where really we start to look at the fundamental structure of atoms. Well, those numbers, that's a huge range, 18 orders of magnitude. And that doesn't even get us to what goes off on the left-hand side of that diagram, talking about the timescales for galactic formation and the duration of the universe since the Big Bang, which is roughly the same scales on the other side. And that's an enormous range of timescales. And to give you some indication of that, I'm going to use Einstein, because this is a talk about science, and every talk about science ought to include Einstein. And I'm going to use perhaps his most important equation, one which I expect that you use very often in your everyday life, and that's this one. Time is money. So if I take that analog and I put on the left-hand side 1 second, And I equate that on the right-hand side to the roughly the debt of the US federal government, about $5 trillion. Then that will give you some sense of what these scales look like. Because 10 femtoseconds, that's 10 to the minus 14 seconds, that's in the regime of molecular motion, is equivalent to about 5 cents on that scale. So that the time scales associated with electronics, for example, your iPhone, your computer, are on the order of $50,000. And the time scale associated with animal motion then are on the order of $500 million. And attoseconds, the extreme right-hand side of that previous diagram, is down in the sort of worthless range. One of those things where you get some object and they say, the monetary value of this is 0.005 cents, you know, nothing. So it's a vast range, of, or almost incomprehensible range of timescales. So how can we possibly make instruments that can access those various different ranges? And it turns out that there are really quite a small number of strategies, really two basic ones. So let me show you where those fit. Let's start at the millisecond range, the idea of animal mechanics. Let's hope this next one works. So you may have seen these pictures before. Let's see if I can get that to go. This is up here, a series of frames that have been compacted into this little pseudo movie here. And these images were taken in the late 19th century by that guy with the beard over there, Edward Muybridge. So he grew up in Kingston on Thames, but these images were made when he was out in California. And he made them actually for a very good reason, for what you might think of as the utilitarian reason for science. He was asked by the governor of California and a railway magnate at the time, Leland Stanford, to resolve a bet as to whether the hooves of a horse left the ground completely while it was galloping. And you can see the answer he showed using this method is yes, it does. So there is a way in which science makes some economic impact. Of course, the economic impact was all for Leland Stanford, but I suppose we might argue that he did some good for society with that money eventually. So how was this done? Well, it was done by having a fast detector. In other words, what he did was he took sunlight was illuminating the horse, so sunlight is shining all the time on the horse. And then he had the horse trip a series of wires as it galloped, and those triggered the shutter of a camera. So the camera opened and closed its shutter very rapidly, more rapidly than the time scale of motion. So that's one general strategy. You just shine light on whatever you want to look at, and then you look at how the dynamics evolves by having a fast detector. Well, that's something that we still use nowadays. And that, let me skip three orders of magnitude there and go to this timescale of electronics, because that's where we still use that sort of technology. For example, if you take a look in your computer, it will have a chip of some kind, probably with high probability it has an Intel chip. And this is one of their, well, this isn't their current generation. Their current generation is called the Core i7. And the high-end version of that has a clock speed of 18.5 gigahertz. A gigahertz is an oscillation, the period of which is a nanosecond. So this is a sub-nanosecond clock period for this computer. And you deal with even faster speeds in the regime of communications, which also happen optically. So look down here first. This is a spec sheet for a photodetector that's used to detect optical signals over long-haul fiber communications. And that's the way all data is transmitted on transoceanic links these days, is with optics. And you see here that this bandwidth of this detector is 18 gigahertz. So that's sort of the ultimate limit of where we can go using the Muybridge technique. Things that turn on and off in timescales of less than a billionth of a second, you can see with these kinds of commercial detectors. And how then the internet makes use of that is sort of shown in this musical score here. So musical score may well be familiar to you, but it's what we would call in physics a spectrogram. Because if you think about this as a graph, you can see that the vertical axis is frequency. That is, the frequency gets higher the further up the stave you go. No, 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 no. It's a little flat at the end. We'll fix that later. And time goes along here. And so the way the optical internet works is that each one of these lines, if you like, is a different information channel. And so each frequency carries information, and it's modulated. So here you see on the... that must be a G, I think. It's not flattened. G? No, it must be... Well, it's a naturalized G, so it would have been G flats G, right? Look along there. You see that happens, that G appears there, and then there, and then there, and then there. So periodically, you get messages on that channel, and that's what these detectors look like. And in fact, what's that? That's called is wavelength division multiplexing, and it's what allows you to get 18 gigahertz information rate on each of these channels. And here you've got five channels, so you've got almost 100 gigahertz of data rate on that system. And the sorts of ways it's used, this is a test diagram from an optical link, and what you see here is the output of that detector versus time. And the way information is coded is on or off. So the light is on, that would be a binary digit, 1, value 1. And if the light's off, then it's a 0. So you see whether this is a good link by seeing whether the light switches from 1 to 0, back to 1, and whether there's a nice, what's called an I in here, which shows you that you can discriminate very well between the on state and the off state. And here you see those timescales there. PS is picosecond. 1 picosecond, remember, is 10 to the minus 12 second, a million millionth of a second. And so these timescales here are on the order of 10 picoseconds. Okay, so that's where one sits in sort of everyday use optics. And that's a pretty impressive number, given the sort of timescales that we're used to in everyday life. But it's by no means the ultimate that you can get. And to get to the other sets of regimes, what you use is a very different technique. And so the technique you use is embodied in this diagram here. And these pictures that I'll show you now, you may well have seen in other contexts as well. So here's a man on a diving board. There's the milk drop again, indicating where... in that regime, in the millionth of a second sort of time scale. And this is an image of a bullet just having split a playing card in two. So a bullet's going at around 300 meters a second or so, or probably faster than that. And here is an early image of a nuclear explosion. And the time scales associated with that are now starting getting down into the nanosecond regime. And there's another one resolved from the Trinity test in 1943. So there's the time scale, and there's the image shown by that. And how this works is a very different manner. It works in the following way. Get this to go. You'll be familiar with it. A short burst of light using a relatively slow detector. So the response time of your eye is around a millisecond. That's why you can see people walking around. It's not much faster than that. And yet you know if you use one of these devices on your camera, you can freeze the motion of things that are much, much faster. And that's how that thing is done there. So here is the guy who came up with, well, he didn't come up with that idea, but he is the person who is perhaps most famous for it because he took all the pictures that I just showed you. This guy's Harold Edgerton, and he worked at MIT in the 1950s.
Is that going to stop there?
Yeah. And there's his, there's the flash that he was using to take those pictures. Repetitive pulsed flash gives you that stroboscopic effect. So what that shows you is you can get down to this regime from the microseconds down to the nanosecond regime using that method. Can you go beyond it? Well, if you want to go beyond it, what you need is a light source which produces pulses that are much, much shorter than the ones that come from a flash camera. And this is a picture of a light source that will do just that. It's pretty obvious how it works, isn't it? So I'll just leave it there. How it works is the following. It's a laser light source, and it works as a sort of optical synthesizer. So a laser you're used to seeing, it has a red beam like this on the laser pointer. What you notice, several features about it, but the one I want to concentrate on tonight is it's on all the time. It's a single color that's on all the time. It's just a nice pure note. Now, how do we represent that? Let me put this up here. Okay, this diagram has got two frames in it. The vertical axis is, if you like, amplitude, whether that's a loud or a quiet note. The horizontal is time. And so what you see here is a wiggle, a wave, if you like, which can be a sound wave, but in the case of the laser, is a light wave. And the time scale of these oscillations for a light wave, for a red light wave, for example, each period is around 2.5 femtoseconds, 2.5 × 10⁻¹⁵ seconds. So very, very short. But it's on all the time, it's just oscillating up and down. And we can plot that in another way. This is called a spectrum. Again, the vertical axis is the amplitude, and the horizontal axis is now frequency. So I put this green line here, sort of representing, well, that's kind of a green frequency. It's a nice pure tone, so it's just a single line. Now, of course, laser pointers don't just come in red. They also come in blue. Actually, you probably can see that better up there. So how would we represent that? Well, that's a blue laser, a different color. If that's that's So now we need something that's a little bit different. Here's the diagram for that blue laser. You see, again, an oscillate. Well, actually, it's the other way around, I should say. Here, a pure tone, but now at a different frequency than the other. And you see that it's a different frequency because the oscillations are different. Now, what happens if I take those two lasers and I'm able to mix them perfectly? What does the resulting light wave look like? Well, you see that in this diagram here. It's got two colours, the blue and the red, and now they're superposed. So look at the waveform here. What you can see is that it begins to have little peaks in it. So that's a nice sign, that's a nice indication that by putting different colours together, we can start to make what you might see as proto-pulses there. So we're on to a good thing. Let's just keep doing it. So now we'll take four different colours, and unfortunately I don't have four differently coloured laser pointers, but you start to get the picture. Four colours, when added together, you can see start to give me sharper peaks. And if I continue to do that, then I have an entire spectrum over here, and what I see is that I start to get these very short bursts of light. Now remember what I told you for the time scale up here. These oscillations have on the scale length of femtoseconds. And what you can see here is that these pulses start to get durations that are down in that regime. So that is what that laser does. That picture that I showed you at the beginning is a laser which harnesses all of these different colours and allows them to all line up so that the waves can add up to give you this. And those pulses are the way in which you can go from the regime of electronics down to the regime of molecular and atomic motion. So, you may believe me, or you may wish to have proof that I can really do this. So you'd like a device that could perhaps measure the duration of these pulses and provide convincing evidence that they really are only that long. But of course, there is a little bit of a problem. As I showed you earlier, the best detectors that you can get have response times on the order of tens to hundreds of picoseconds. And I'm claiming these pulses are more than 1,000 times shorter than that. So how am I going to deal with that? Well, it turns out that it's possible to build such build instruments like that. And I'm not going to go into any detail about how you do it, but that has been an active area of research. And this is a device that we built in the group at Oxford. And it's in the exhibit, in Stephen's exhibit, so you can go and have a look at that at some point in the future. But this is a device which allows you to measure the duration of pulses that are down in that regime of 10 to 100 femtoseconds. And you can see, well, that was an advertising bit. You can see that it fits in the palm of your hand. That's also the giant hand of St. Cross. It's 5 meters across. It's in another part of the museum, I think, Jim, isn't it? So those are instruments that you now use to determine how your light sources are performing. But once you've got such instruments, you can start to explore a fantastic array of different sorts of light sources. And again, I'm not going to go into any detail into what these are, but here is a light source with a really broad spectrum that's got a lot of structure in it. And this represents how light propagates down an optical fiber when you turn the power up a bit too much. And you start to get all sorts of crazy effects that have very interesting phenomenology. Here's a sort of light pulse that some colleagues in Germany built. And the purpose of that is to tickle a molecule in the right way to make it dance in the way that you'd like to have it move around. And I'll talk a little more about that in a second. And then here's one where it really was possible to get down to this regime of having almost a single optical cycle, just a really fast glint of light. And that's one of the shortest pulses that people have made. And then, of course, you can come up with things that are even wackier, and here's our own musical score. Again, it's like a musical score because on this axis here is frequency. That's the lines on your stave. And on this axis is time. And the time scales are a bit different than your acoustic musical score because going from here to here is 2 picoseconds. And going from here to here, you change by about half a terahertz. Terahertz is an oscillation frequency of 10 to the 12 times per second. And here's some even more crazy pulses that one just has fun with on occasion. Okay, so that's how you get down into this regime of a million millionth of a second to a million billionth of a second. And that's the time scale over which the motion in atoms and molecules proceeds. So what you can start to do now is to build molecular movies. And there's where that weird shaped German pulse comes into it. Because what you do here is you take a molecule. Now, what's this diagram supposed to represent? A molecule. To the aficionados among you, you'll know what it means. To those not, don't worry about it. Essentially, what I want you to note is that you take your burst of light and you shine it on your molecule. And what your molecule does then is absorb some energy from that light beam and start to wiggle. And then you use light again to watch it wiggle, because as it oscillates back and forth, it also will emit light. And the kind of light it emits depends on its particular configuration at any instant in time. So by watching it using that flash technique, only now the flash is a laser pulse that's about, in this case, about 20 femtoseconds long, you can start to see oscillations. And so here's some pictures from my laboratory showing exactly that. Again, this is intensity versus time, and you see these wiggles as this molecule vibrates and gyrates around. And those are the kinds of oscillations that tell you, that carry information about what that molecule is doing. There's some more pictures there, I won't go into that. And that idea is one that has been around for some time and led to this guy, Ahmed Zewail, getting the Nobel Prize for Chemistry in 1999 for making these movies that show molecules not just vibrating around, but actually undergoing reactions. So starting down here, moving up because of light excitation onto here, rattling around here, and going down into another part of the molecular structure. So being able to change from one molecule into another. And he was able to watch that. And since that's such a fundamental process in chemical reactions, understanding what's called this transition state chemistry really unlocked a lot of new possibilities, which is why he won the prize. Okay. That's the femtosecond domain. But there's another application here that actually led to another Nobel Prize only 6 years ago for Ted Hench and Jan Hall. And that's based on not just on the time domain idea, but on those spectra that I showed you. You recall that a short pulse, or a train of short pulses, was made up of a lot of different frequency components. And that allows you to build something called an optical clockwork, right? So here's a spectrum of a particular laser pulse or a laser pulse train that these guys were able to build. And you see the characteristic. There's different intensities of different frequency components in there. And what these guys were able to do was to precisely locate where each of these frequencies is. And if you know exactly where those are, it's like a little comb. And so you have a comb, which is this long, but with teeth that are very finely spaced. And so what you can do is connect a very small interval very precisely to a very big interval by knowing precisely where those teeth are located. And what that allows you to do is to connect the stable transitions in an atom, which, as I've sort of indicated, are optical frequencies, terahertz, with microwave frequencies, which is where you'd like to have your clock speeds for internet, or more importantly, for a global positioning system. So this allows you to use very stable atoms to give you really precise time standards, which you then, again, can use for other applications. So that clockwork is that optical clockwork is a crucial piece of technology, and is not quite yet at the level of becoming the time standard that we base all our time standards on, but is almost there. And what's really neat is the way in which, how do you know whether the teeth are located there or located there or over there? How do you know where each of these lines is spaced? Well, it's a beautiful, simple trick. You say, well, okay, let me just take this comb tooth here. That's at some frequency. Let's call it F. And I'm going to put it in. I'm going to double that in some way. I'm going to put it to the next octave up. And then I'm going to take a tooth comb out here, and I'm going to see if that's the same frequency. And if those two are exactly the same frequency, then you have positioned the teeth of that comb perfectly. And you can tell, it turns out, whether those two are the same frequency through very, very precise rendering. It's just like when you tune your guitar. I'm sure you've all tried that, or your violin. Well, how do you do it? Well, you look for a harmonic on one string to coincide with the fundamental of the next one. And when they're slightly off, what you can hear is a little beat note. And that beat note is sub-hertz. It's frequencies of around, well, it's probably not in the acoustic range, but it's around hertz, right? It's on the order of a few cycles per second. Well, it turns out you can do the same in the optical regime. So you can locate a terahertz frequency, an oscillation that's going at a million times a second, to within a fraction of a hertz, a fraction of an oscillation that takes place on the time scale of a second. So you have precisions here of greater than 1 part in 10 to the 12th, which is a remarkable technology. Where else are you going to use these things? Okay, here's another example of how short laser pulses are used in microscopy. So this bit up here is a way that you make short pulses using the method that I showed you earlier, synthesizing lots of different frequencies. You can see the different frequencies split out over here. This device here allows you to play with them a bit, but a way that doesn't worry us now. And then you put it into a microscope down here, and you put your sample in the middle there. And it turns out that these short pulses of light have quite a high energy right at the peak. And you can cause appropriate excitation of various molecules. So here's an example of that from Martin Booth's group in engineering science. It's a mouse embryo using this technique that I just showed you. And you can see the difference between doing it with an ordinary microscope and using these short laser pulses. Much, much better resolution image. So there's another way in which these short laser pulses are used. Another example, again, back from telecoms, sort of state-of-the-art telecoms, 40 to 100 gigahertz test beds. When you get to that bandwidth on your telecommunications rig, you have to be very careful with the pulses you put down it, because they tend to break up as they move down the optical fiber. And so these guys use those laser pulses, or use pulses like I've shown you, to try and understand what the properties of those fiber links are, and how you might then compensate for the distortions that you get, make sure your internet continues to work. Now, as you get down to even shorter and shorter pulses, and this is one of those that's right in the regime of a couple of cycles. You can sort of count the optical cycles here, and this is about 3 optical cycles long. So really, really short, down below 10 femtoseconds. Now, even a tiny amount of energy in one of those pulses starts to give you a very high peak intensity. And if you're clever, you can amplify that up so that you get really, really high intensities. And here's an example of that. This particular image is from Simon Hooker's group in the Clarendon lab. I'm afraid that's not showing very well. But a short pulse with a reasonable amount of energy gives you a very high peak intensity, on the order of 1,000,000 terawatts per centimeter squared. Terawatt, what's that? A unit of power. You're used to your light bulbs being 60 watts, right? Terawatt is 10 to the 12th, 1,000,000,000 times more bright than a light bulb. In fact, if you take the entire power consumption of the Earth, it's around a terawatt and a half, I think. Is that right? Sorry, 3.18 terawatts. So you can get laser pulses in your laboratory, the peak power of which is equivalent to the entire electrical output of the world. So you might well be thinking, when Simon turns on his laser, why doesn't everything carry on? Yeah. Well, the answer, of course, is that there's very little energy in these pulses because they're so brief. So although the peak power is very high, the total energy is very small. But these sort of things allow you to do quite amazing things, because the electric field associated with these pulses is now comparable with the electric field that holds electrons inside atoms. And so you can really start to go in there and really mess around with the atom in a serious way. And in fact, what you can do this way is build accelerators out of lasers. So you can use lasers to accelerate electrons and other particles up to very, very high energies. In fact, you can create these very high temperatures very, very quickly, and you can induce very unusual states of matter called plasmas. And there are strategies down the road at Rutherford Appleton Lab. People are exploring the way in which you can use lasers to generate such high temperatures and high densities that you can create controlled nuclear fusion, which we hope one day to be able to build into a power plant, because you do this by atomic fusion, which is a very, very plentiful supply of energy. And there are, of course, lots of issues associated with it, but the good point is that it tends to be a lot cleaner than fission. You could also use this as an energy source for ultra-fast X-ray lasers. And X-rays I haven't gotten into, but those are really, really short wavelengths. I'm sure you've seen them at the hospital where you might have had an X-ray image done or a CAT scan. But the wavelength actually is really so short that it's about equivalent to the spacing of atoms in a molecule. And so it turns out that you can take images of molecules using these light sources. And because they're very brief, you can look at changes in structure on these very short timescales. And I said you can build an accelerator, and the idea is that you can build on your tabletop a device which can perhaps replace CERN, well, at least the pre-LHC version of CERN. So we'll see if we can really see the Higgs boson in the lab next door. Okay, so where's the final stage, or at least not the final stage, but the stage where we are currently at? And that's in this regime of a billion billionth of a second duration. And the time scale there is the time scale in which electrons move inside atoms. And electrons are really, really light particles. They're more 2,000 times lighter than a proton, and a proton is 10 to the minus 27 kilograms. So that's a really small amount of mass. It means it can move very, very quickly. So how do you look at such things? Again, you use the fact that when atoms are in intense laser fields, so here's an argon jet, little argon atoms, you shine your short light pulse on it, and when you're not in this regime that you generate nuclear fusion, but dialed down a bit from there, what you see is something like this. This is called a harmonic spectrum. The vertical axis is the one to look at. This is the wavelength now. So we're shining light on that atom. And the light that we're shining on it is roughly red. It's a little redder than this. So that's a wavelength of about 800 nanometers, just shy of 1 micron. And you can see here we're getting wavelengths down at 50 nanometers or so. Because these are harmonics. Remember, harmonics. So I start low, and I sing high, and I go up. And I go up, every time I go from one of these, I go up 2 octaves. And so by the time I've got up here, I've got a really short wavelength that's about the tenth, more than the tenth harmonic of the original light. And the reason that that's important is the following. I showed you that you could, in principle, get down to sort of single-cycle pulses. But single-cycle at this wavelength is 2.5 femtoseconds. That's not nearly short enough. So how am I going to get even shorter? Well, I need a shorter wavelength. The cycle for the blue laser is around 1.5 femtoseconds. So the bluer I can get it, the shorter a single cycle is, so the shorter pulse I can eventually make. And that's why I need these harmonics. So that as I get down to here, I start to get into the regime of durations that are less than a femtosecond long. Less than a million millionth of a second long. And that is the key now to accessing this new regime. And here's an example of that. Now, you see here, just vertical axis is, well, it's an electron energy, don't worry too much about that, versus time. What do you see here? Well, you see these wiggles in the electron energy. What's that? That is the shape of one of the optical pulses that I showed you earlier, used to probe nuclear motion in molecules, read out by an attosecond pulse generated using those high harmonics. So you can resolve the individual oscillations of an optical field using these really, really short pulses. And when you get into that regime, this attosecond regime, you start to be able to see crazy stuff. Like here is an image of some of electrons oscillating inside an atom. And you can see the time scale, the complete time scale for that is 6 femtoseconds, and you really have enough resolution there to make a movie of those electrons moving around. Well, atoms are a nice testbed, but of course what you would like to go on to do is look at more electron motion in more complicated structure. Because, for example, if you think about the first steps in vision, what are those to do with? Well, they're to do with photoreceptors in your eye, molecules which absorb light and convert it into an electrical current that can flow down your optic nerve. And therefore, that generation of light into electron motion in molecules is a key first step in this very important and fundamental bioprocess. And so that's what people are beginning to look at now. And you can not only see molecules vibrating, you can also see them exploding. Because each of those little harmonics that I showed you comes out at a different time. So by looking at when these harmonics come out, you can get a picture of how the molecule falls apart on this highly repulsive potential surface. So that's where we are currently. That's kind of state of the art in ultra-fast science. So what happens next? Well, the next acronym down, or the next prefix down at 10 to the minus 21 seconds is the zettosecond regime. So that's the next target. And what happens at that time scale? Well, that starts to get to the edge of the times that the time scales associated with neutrons and protons moving inside atomic nuclei. So you can really start to get down into this really, really tiny regime by looking on very short time scales. Just as when you look out at the night sky, at the galaxies and the stars, what you're doing is looking way back in time, the ultra-slow regime of billions of years ago. So, in a sense, fast means very small, and slow means very large. Anyway, I hope that some of you are around for when we do eventually reach that regime. Thanks for your attention.